one of my favorite short stories, one of my favorite parables, is The Pearl by Steinbeck. And if you know the story at all, remember the main characters are Kino and Juana. Kino is a very poor Mexican pearl diver, and his wife, Juana, is just a good woman. And they have a little baby named Coyotito. And I'm not going to give you the end, but I will give you the beginning, because the beginning is quite a shock. Is right at the beginning of the book, within the first couple pages, they're living in their shack, and a scorpion gets into Coyotito. Coyotito's a very small baby, gets into Coyotito's crib and stings him. And so they take him, they immediately rush him to the doctor in the town, and the doctor, you know, is this fat, sort of greasy, white guy, and the doctor basically says, "I won't treat Coyo unless you have money." And so, of course, Kino says, "I've got to do something in order to get my son treated." And so what he does is he and Juana go out on his little tiny rowboat to dive for pearls. And while he is down there, the story is fascinating because he hears the music of the sea and the music of pearls. And as he's diving for pearls, he's tossing them up in the boat, and they finally get up in the boat, and they begin to open the oysters to see if there are any pearls. And behold, he finds the pearl of the world. It's as big as a gull's egg. And as soon as he sees this pearl that is as big as the gull's egg, immediately his thoughts begin to race at how all of his problems will be over. Not only will Coyotito be healed because the doctor will see him, but they will be the wealthiest people in the city, and everyone will love them because they are so wealthy and prosperous now. It's sort of like someone who wins the lottery. And his thoughts race forward, but you know what? That doesn't happen. When he brings the pearl into the city, something strange happens to the people. And it's actually not strange if you believe what the Bible says about human nature. Just listen to what it says. He brings the pearl in, and it says, "All manner of people grew interested in Kino, people with things to sell and people with favors to ask. Kino had the pearl of the world. The essence of the pearl mixed with the essence of men, and a curious dark residue was precipitated. Every man suddenly became related to Kino's pearl, and Kino's pearl went into the dreams, the speculations, the schemes, the plans, the futures, the wishes, the needs, the lusts, the hungers of everyone. And the one person who stood in the way of all that was Kino. So that he became curiously every man's enemy. The news stirred up something infinitely black and evil in the town, and the black distillate was like the scorpion, or like the hunger and the smell of food, or like loneliness when love is withheld. The poison sacks of the town began to manufacture venom, and the town swelled and puffed with the pressure of it." You see, Kino became wealthy. And by achieving this great wealth, he immediately thought there will be joy and peace and prosperity, but in fact, there was not. What he ends up having is tragedy and despair, and ultimately, he loses it all. And you see, we're going to look at Abram's text today, and the same thing happens. You see, remember, I'm preaching through the life of Abram now, and you remember in Genesis 12, when the whole thing started, God came to Abram, and he said, I promise you, he calls him out of the land of Ur, and he says, "I promise you, I'm going to give you this land over here, the promised land." And he says, "I'm going to make your name great, and I will bless you. And you, Abram, will be a blessing to all the families on the earth." And remember, last week I preached that Abram, as soon as the promise was challenged, he began to lie and scheme. Right? He began to lie and scheme when he got to Egypt to sort of cover his own butt. And his lying and his scheming, he ended up losing his wife, but getting great wealth in the process. And you remember last week that God intervened, and he delivered Abram from his sin. And he lets him go out of Egypt back to the promised land, and he gets to leave with all of the wealth that Pharaoh gave him for his wife. And you would be tempted to think, that is beautiful. God not only delivered Abram, but he got to be rich on top of all that. But you know what? Life is not that easy. Life is not that easy at all. And so what we're going to look at this morning first is the consequence of sin. The consequence of sin. You see, Abram sinned greatly in Egypt, and you would think that his wealth was a blessing. But it wasn't. It was a consequence. Look at, if you have your text, if you don't have a Bible, it's on the back of your announcement sheet. In Genesis 13, I'm going to read the first seven verses. We're going to sort of work our way through this It says, so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, and he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. Now Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and gold. He went on his journey from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tents had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, and to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanites and Perizzites were also in the land. You see, the first thing Abram has to deal with is the consequence of his sin. And it may surprise many of you that the consequence of Abram's sin is not poverty. The dire consequence of Abram's sin is great wealth. Okay? The problem that Abram had, you see, he came out of Egypt with all this great wealth, but there was a big problem. The problem was simply this, is that Lot also was very wealthy. And not only that, there are two problems here. Lot was very wealthy and has a lot of stuff, and the Canaanites and Perizzites were still in the land. What does that mean? You see, because some of you might think, this is a promised land. Can it sustain two families? Well, in fact, the families were probably 300 or 400 persons each. With all of their slaves, there would be many nations, if you will, many economies. And so what you have is a very limited space and two families with a lot of stuff. And so what Abram, imagine how Abram felt. The story is actually quite, it's genius. Because imagine how Abram feels. He has been delivered from Egypt. He is greatly wealthy. And he begins, the text takes us back today where he began before he went into Egypt. He got a fresh start, if you will. So imagine Abram, he has come out of Egypt, he is extremely wealthy, and he thinks, this is beautiful, I get a fresh start. I'm back at the place where I worshiped God, and so he worships God, and he goes to church, and then he goes home after a big Sunday lunch, and he puts his feet up on the couch to watch a football game, and someone knocks on the door. Abram, we've got problems outside. What do you mean? Everything's beautiful. We've been delivered from Egypt. And he says, well, the problem is that our herdsmen are trying to kill Lot's herdsmen, and Lot's herdsmen are trying to kill your herdsmen. You see, the great wealth he had was actually the first threat to the promise. You see, the great wealth that he had, the consequence of his sin, you would think, was a threat to the promise. Now, you're tempted to think, if you watch television much, that this is a blessing, right? That Abram's wealth was a blessing. Right? Isn't that just like God? He not only delivers, but he gives Abram a lot of money, and that's what the faith is about. It's not. You see, the great wealth and the consequence of his sin is a blessing. But it's not like you think. And you see, this is very instructive for us because of this. Just because God delivers you from your sin, you trust Jesus to forgive all your sin, that doesn't mean your problems go away. When you trust Jesus to forgive your sin, that does not mean your problems go away. In fact, oftentimes it is the case that they get worse. And not only that, when you trust Jesus to forgive all of your sin, you don't wake up the next morning and say, you know, I've lived a promiscuous life my whole life, and I've trusted Jesus to forgive my sin, and you don't wake up the next morning and say, now I don't have sexually transmitted diseases anymore. He's taken away everything. No, you have them still. You don't say, I've trusted Jesus to forgive all my sin, and along with it, he took away the $18,000 of credit card debt that I have. It doesn't work that way. It's very instructive for us because of this, because of the fact that the consequences keep us honest. The consequences of our sin are not a curse, but in fact, they are a blessing, and they are a blessing because they keep us honest. They make us have to depend upon Jesus. Do you see that? You see, if they live this life of some kind of sin and Jesus forgives them all, and if all of a sudden the consequences were cleared away, how quickly do you think you would fall into the same trap again? Very quickly. But since we have to deal with the consequences, we must live this ongoing life of trust in Jesus, and therefore the consequences are a blessing. They keep you honest. And you see, that's what Abram has to deal with now. He has to look and say, I have consequences of my sin. They're a threat to the promise. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? You see, he could have done a couple things. He could have simply said to Lot, hey, I'm the man. I am the bearer of blessing. God promised me this land, and not only that, but you know, I'm your pappy. You ought not start what you need to do. You just need to leave. He could have asserted his promise, and he could have asserted his seniority and told Lot just to get out of there with nothing. Or he could have claimed the promise. He could have asserted the promise, and he could have recited it to Lot and said, "Lot, are you going to complain about that? Are you going to buck God?" And instead of asserting his right, and instead of asserting the promise, what he does is he chooses to believe the promise. That Abram chooses to believe the promise here. That's very important for you to get. But that brings me to my next point, which is the cost of reconciliation. The cost of reconciliation. Look at verses 8 and 9. It says, "So Abram said to Lot, 'Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen or your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right. If to the right, then I will go to the left.'" You see, what Abram did here is basically he learned his lesson in Egypt. Is he going to be self-sufficient? Or is he going to believe the promise God made to him? And by believing the promise that God made to him, Abram is able, in fact, to give up his rights. He gives up his rights because he must have thought to himself, "Hey, God promised me this whole land. In order to keep strife from happening, I'll just give up my rights. Because if the promise is true, God's not going to let Lot do anything evil to me. If the promise is true, I'm going to have everything." And so what he does is he says, "Lot, what I want you to do is you take whatever you want." He gives Lot this choice. Now, this is very interesting here, because what this would have done, the original audience, the Israelites in the desert, this would have both horrified them and challenged them. Why? Because Abram gives Lot this choice of anywhere he wants to go in the promised land. Well, Lot would become the father of the Moabites and the Ammonites, and the Moabites and the Ammonites would have become the arch enemies of Israel. And so they would have been horrified. "Abram, what are you doing? You know what is going to happen, that he's going to father the Moabites, and they're going to fight against us the rest of their lives." But there's something else that's even more subtle here. It's really subtle. And the Israelites, when they would have read it, it would have raised their eyebrows, and they would have said, "Ooh, what's he trying to get out here?" And it's this. Abram says to Lot, a beautiful word, he says to him, Lot, "Let us not have strife." And this word strife in Hebrew is meribah. So Abram says this very, it seems like he just sort of says it very, very casually. "Lot, let us not have meribah." Now see, that would have been the word. That would have been the thing that would have shocked the Israelites. Why? Because Meribah was the place where God did the exact same thing for them. You see, when they were first delivered from Egypt, as soon as they got out in the wilderness, as soon as God made them a promise that "I will deliver you and I will finish the job," and as soon as things got hard, immediately, they didn't have any water to drink. And you know what Exodus 17 says? I'm going to turn there in a second. Exodus 17 says, "And they Meribahed against Moses and against God." They strove against God. They had conflict with God because of limited resources, you see. And then you have this wild scene set up because God gets very angry at this, as you can imagine. He's just delivered them, and they slap him in the face, and God gets angry. And look at at Exodus 17, or if you don't have a Bible, that's fine. I'll read it to you. Moses comes to God, and he says, "What shall I do? These people are Meribahing against me and against you. They're going to kill me." And God gets very angry. And in verse 5 of Exodus 17, he says this, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go.'" You don't want to hear God say that. You see, God is very upset. And so what he has told Moses to do, "Moses, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get all the elders of the people, and I want you to pass in front of them." So what is happening here is that God is setting up a court case. He says, "Get the elders, and the elders are going to be the jury. And I want you to take them and pass them in front of the people." The people have been very frightened to see this happen. And the last thing, what does he say? And he says, "And oh, by the way, remember that rod that you judged Israel or Egypt with?" He says, "Take that rod." You're right, because someone's getting a whip. And so God takes the elders, and he takes Moses out into the desert, and the people are extremely afraid, and then God says, "Bring the rod of judgment down upon the people." No, he doesn't say that. You see, he would have created all this dissonance because what he says in verse 6, he says, take the rod, and then he says, behold, I, God, will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, so that the people may drink. Do you see what has happened here? God says, Moses, there's going to be judgment here because there must be judgment against the striving and complaining. But instead of asserting his rights to judge them, what God does is he gives them up. This is the Old Testament, friends. God in the Old Testament, he says, Moses, I will stand upon the rock. And you bring the rod of judgment down upon me. And when you bring the rod of judgment down upon me, water will flow from the rock and my people will be saved. And then the next verse he says, and I want you to call this place Meribah. So that every time the Israelites think of Meribah, they would remember not only the time that God had delivered them from their sins and bore their own judgment, but this when he had provided for them as well. And the Apostle Paul makes an interesting connection in the New Testament because he says this. He says, of that scene, he says, and the Israelites drank water from the rock, and that rock was Christ. You see, the Israelites could have looked back. And whenever something bad happened in their life, you know, they should have preached to themselves, remember Meribah. And what the New Testament says to us is whenever things are going bad, whenever troubles hit, you say, remember the cross. Because you see, at the cross was Jesus' Meribah. The cross is when God said, I have had enough. I've had enough of their striving, I've had enough of their Meribah, I've had enough of their complaining and their sin, and because of that, there will be judgment. Someone is going to pay. And instead of saying, put Tommy on that cross and just judge him, bring down all of my wrath upon him, what he says is, behold, I, Jesus, get upon that cross. And I bear all of your sin, I bear all of your judgment, and because of that, I gave up all my rights. And if you understand that, you can believe the gospel. You see, when things go badly with you, you say, remember Meribah. Remember the cross. Remember that time when Jesus bore my sin. And because of that, he promised that he would take care of me forever. It's only that that enables Abram to be able to give up the land because he realizes he's got nothing to lose because, in fact, he has already gained everything. Now, what's interesting is, remember I told you last week, you should always watch when the Bible compares people. You know, now Saul was wicked, but David was good. But Saul, what happens here is, you see, now Abram said to Lot. And then the next thing we see is that Lot says, you see, now that Abram has put the ball in Lot's court, Lot has to make a decision. Lot has to make a decision based on what Abram, the blessing bearer, has said. And there are really two choices that Abram has. One of them is so obvious, or it would have been at least to the original audience, that it's not even stated in the text. Abram says to Lot, Lot, you go wherever you want. You go to the east, I'll go to the west. If you go to the north, I will go to the south. Take whatever you want, Lot, and just go. And the first choice Lot would have had would have been this. It's not in the text. The first choice Lot would have had is this. Abram, you're the blessing bearer. God gave you the promise, and God told you that whoever blesses you will be blessed, and whoever curses you will be cursed, and whoever lives in this land will be blessed. Abram, I'm willing to do anything it takes to be reconciled to you. Lot could have said that. He could have said, Abram, I'm willing to give away all of my herds, all of everything, just so I can be in your presence, because you're the blessing bearer. I'm not. The other choice, of course, that he had was anything he wanted. And so look at verse 10 on your sheet. Verse 10 says this, it's very telling. It says, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Oh, wait. That it was well watered everywhere. This was, now notice the editorial comments. It was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Why? Because it would not be well-watered after fire and brimstone. In fact, it would be pretty toasty. That it was well-watered like the garden of the Lord. And here's another editorial comment. Like the land of Egypt, as far as you go to Zoar. You see, Abram has given Lot this choice. One of them implicit. Give away everything and follow me. The other choice, of course, is anything he wants. And Lot, it says he lifted up his eyes and looked across the plain of the Jordan. And where he looks is outside the promised land. And he says that it was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, it's paradise. And then, of course, it says what? That it was like Egypt. Now, you see, if you're an Israelite, you don't want something to be like Egypt. You want it to be as far away from being like Egypt as possibly can. But he looks out and he sees with his eyes that which looks attractive. And throughout this whole passage, we have these editorial notes that Lot wouldn't have known, but the Israelites would have caught, that it was well watered. But this was before God judged Sodom and Gomorrah. And the men of Sodom and Gomorrah were exceedingly wicked. You see, Lot was going on sight, not faith. And so the choice is laid out before Lot. Follow the blessing bearer, or follow that which is the easy, sure thing. You know, the red pill or the blue pill? Door number one or door number two? You see, Lot, door number one, you live with the blessing bearer. You lose everything and you're poor, but you get to live with the blessing bearer in the land of promise. Door number two, garden of the Lord. Just like the land of Egypt. It's well watered everywhere. What are you going to take, buddy? Door number one or door number two? Drum roll, please. Door number two, he gets the land of Egypt. Congratulations, Lot, you lose. You lose, Lot. You see, from this point on, Lot is throughout the rest of the Bible is the biggest buffoon you could ever meet. Everything he touches screws up. Everything he tries to do is messed up. And Lot is a believer. Lot's not some nasty pagan. He is a believer who walked by sight, and for the rest of his life, he will pay for that. And you see, Jesus lays that same choice before every one of us, whether you're a Christian or non-Christian. Jesus says to every one of us, he says, look at me. Right? He says, like I say to my children, look at my eyes. He says, here's your choice. You follow me, the blessing bearer. You follow me, the one who is the fulfillment of all the promises of God, and you have no guarantees. You lose everything, maybe. Follow me, or take that which you can see. Take that which you can see, taste, feel, the sort of the sure thing that you know is going to, you know for now at least, is going to make you happy, or you think as much. And you would think it would be a no-brainer, that choice, but it's not, is it? I mean, some of you I know, you know, you're contemplating marrying men that you probably shouldn't marry. Why? Because you're afraid of being lonely. So you look out and you say, I would rather take the sure thing than trust that God's going to take care of me the rest of my life. Some of you think about former sins. Former financial things, former sexual things, and you say, I knew I had momentary punctuated happiness as I engaged in those activities. I don't know that I'm going to have that with Jesus. Even though he promised it to me. Well, Jesus says, what are you going to do? That was the decision laid before Lot. And you would think it would be a no-brainer, but it wasn't. Lot did the same thing that most of us do, whether you're a Christian or non-Christian, most of the time, is that we walk by sight instead of faith. We look out and say, I'm going to make a lot of money. It must be God's will. I hear that all the time. And that's just not true. And if you're wondering, if you question at all whether or not it's a no-brainer, if you question or not whether or not, you know, Abram made the right choice and Lot made the right choice, all you have to do is look at the next part of the passage, which is simply God's assurance of the promise. Look at the last part. Abram, remember, Lot took it, and it says that Lot left. He went towards Sodom. And now this beautiful part, and I want you to notice the parallelism. In verse 14, it says, now the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated him, now lift up your eyes. Do you see that? Lot was offered the choice, and it says he lifted up his eyes, and he saw how well-watered everything was, and he took it. And then you can imagine Abram going, either being sad because Lot left, or sad because Lot actually got the best land, you see? And God comes to him and he says, Abram, now you lift up your eyes. And it says, and look from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. You see, God comes to Abram, and he teaches him the same lesson, although it's not a sharp lesson that Raggedy Ann learned. Now, many of you have heard this story again, but it bears repeating because I'm sure you forgot it. Remember, you know, if you have 3 or 4 or 5 year olds, you probably have the complete works of Raggedy Ann on your shelf. And you remember the first story of Raggedy Ann? Marcella finds Raggedy Ann in the attic, and she's completely disgusting. She's dirty, and she has holes, and she needs to be sewn up, and she takes her and repairs her and makes her better. And then in the next story, what is it? Raggedy Ann learns a lesson. What's the lesson she learned? You see, Raggedy Ann is sort of the ringleader of all the other dolls, and as soon as Marcella leaves for the day, the other dolls begin to grumble and say, you know, she doesn't really take care of us unless she should. She doesn't give us all the good things that she has to offer. I say we raid the kitchen. And now they go, yeah. And so they all go in while Marcella's gone. They creep through the kitchen, you see, because they can only walk while she's not there. They creep through the kitchen, and they break into the pantry, and they come upon the greatest store of all of heaven and earth, a big jar of raspberry jam. And all of the toys dip themselves in raspberry jam, and they're eating it. They're completely covered with raspberry jam. Then they hear the door creak. And then they all take off running. But as soon as Marcella gets in the room, they lose their powers of bipedalism, right? They can't walk anymore. And so Marcella walks in, and they all fall down. And they're completely covered with raspberry jam. They're disgusting again. And what do you think Marcella does? Does she go to them and say, oh, you nasty, disgusting little dolls, I'm going to take you and burn you up and buy new dolls at Toys R Us? Marcella doesn't say a word. Marcella gathers up all of the dolls, and it says she took them and washed them squeaky clean and spotlessly white. And then she took them and laid a feast before them of dainties and cakes and Earl Grey tea. And Marcella leaves again, and as soon as she leaves again, the dolls are animated. And Raggedy Ann speaks up, and you know what she says? She says, I think she's trying to teach us a lesson. And the other toys say, what do you mean? And Raggedy Ann says something, and I'm paraphrasing now. Raggedy Ann says, we tried to get all of the goods for ourselves, when the whole time, she would have willingly given us anything we wanted. You see, that's the lesson that Abram learns. He learns it because he acted on faith. But that's the lesson that we have to learn. You see, we sit in the crux of this, you know, do I go to Sodom or do I follow the blessing bearer? And the assurance is this, that you don't have to go to Sodom. You don't have to go to the land east of the Jordan to get what you need, because Jesus willingly will grant you everything you need, more than you could ever ask or imagine. Let me pray. Jesus, I pray that you would impress upon our minds your promise. And I pray that you would, even right now, as people are contemplating, would impress upon some people that they must and need to choose you, the blessing bearer, to put their faith in you as opposed to themselves, as opposed to the riches and wealth that they see around them. So I thank you that you see fit to even impress this upon any of us. In your name we pray. Amen.